This episode of Unquasi Unfiltered is brought to you by MTN Zambia.
There's no us without you, so we say thank you.
There was some German guy that came here. He offered us $5 million to get the building. And we looked at him and said, no, we're not selling it. And he said, $5 million? No, we're not selling it. All of us were on the same. And there is no division on that issue.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So that's your dad.
That's the key.
Installation of his legacy, actually.
Yeah. He drummed it into us.
Yeah. No, I can see you're still trembling a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, never sell.
Never. It didn't matter what you're talking about. He would always throw that in there. He said, you know, last night, Manchester United won, but never sell Silver.
Good morning and happy Saturday, cold Saturday. Today, I have with me in the studio, Chitambala Mwewa, otherwise known as Simon Mwewa Lane. Somehow, I prefer to call him Chitambala because it feels unique. But he's with us today. Awesome businessman, digital content producer, influencer, socialist, activist, all in our CBD, in the center of Lusaka, street conversationist, and brings a lot to the table. And I'm so excited to have him here because you know what? He's also going to teach me a couple of words, how to pronounce them. He's already taught me how to pronounce his name because I said Chitambala. It's Chitambala. So that's a great start already. So I'm really excited to have some teachings on the platform, and I'd like to welcome you to the morning. How are you?
Very well, and thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan of the show. I watch it all the time.
We watch you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, no, we love it.
Thank you.
Yeah, so the name, everyone knows you by Simon Mwewa Lane, which comes from your dad, I guess. Mm. But how have you created this name, this brand? How did it all start? Because first of all, you're in the States, and I want to know that story.
Mm.
What then happened, and how did you land here?
By plane. Well, to all the way back to the beginning, Simon Mwewa Lane is the name of the street
that
Simoson is located on.
That's right.
Right.
And named after?
My late father.
Your late father. And yes. At the time it was a lane, but it's like...
It was a nameless street.
Yeah.
What used to happen was many years ago, about 20 years ago, we used to pay Mukobeko Prison a million kwacha per month in those days. A million in those days. Not a million now.
Yeah.
And they used to come through every week to sweep the street. Mm. And we did it because, you know, that's where we work, that's where we spend our working life.
So the prisoners would come to clean.
Right, every week, though, but we'd pay them monthly. And after a few years, we wrote to the council and we said, look, this street doesn't have a name.
Mm-hmm.
It would be befitting if you named it after my late father, because not only was he Lusaka mayor, he served as governor, and really, he opened the commerce, the business side of things in that part of town. And we thought that it would be a good idea for the council. And they agreed. And they honored us by it was Mayor Chikwelete at the time who actually approved that. And he came and he officially unveiled it as Simon Mwewa Lane. So that's where the name came from.
Try having a road named after you today.
I would imagine it's a bit of a steep climb. But in those days, I think the council saw the sense in it, and we were very grateful for that. And fast forward to a few years later, it was during COVID, actually, mm-hmm. 2017, when the government at that time shut down the CBD.
Yes.
Lots of people don't realize that there was a time that the CBD, namely Lumumba Road, was literally shut down. Yeah. Nobody could go in.
No.
Nobody could go out.
So probably people don't recognize that or remember that it was shut down because nobody went there.
Yes, and the reason it was shut down because of cholera.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was one of the only ones that was actually filming the street as the army came through to clear the entire street. And I remember asking an army officer permission to record. And he says, you can record, but don't show our faces. And I realized in that moment, because I'll do these live videos.
Yeah, you know.
And then all of a sudden, I noticed there were 3,000 to 4,000 people watching. And at that time, my page was, I think I only had like 7,000 people on there as followers. But, you know, 5,000 people, and I was shocked. I thought, where are these people coming from? And I realized the reason they were tuning in was because not even ZNBC was coming to the CBD.
Right.
Everybody was shut out.
Yeah.
And that's where the traction for the page came from. But the inspiration, to answer your question, the inspiration behind the name was, I know you know the Beatles.
Of course.
Right. There's a very famous album cover of the Beatles crossing a street in England Abbey Road.
I've been there, yes.
You know Abbey Road?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's what inspired me. I was, because you know, if you go to England, you ask anyone, where is Abbey Road? Chances are they'll tell you.
Yeah.
So my line of logic was create this persona around the street to where people instantly know, where is Simon Ware Lane? Oh, it's over there. Yeah.
Got it. Well, we've come back to understand where the CBD is, where Simon Ware Lane is, and thank you for bringing that back. But I still want to go back to how you came to being back in Zambia.
From the States. Well, it's a long story.
We're here.
Yeah, and that's why we're here. Here it is. In August of 1989, I went to Louisiana, Baton Rouge, the capital city of Louisiana.
Yeah.
And I studied theology there.
Yes.
And I was there for about 4 years in college. I graduated and I decided at that time to possibly live there. And I was going to possibly raise a family there.
So theology again, I need to understand that. Why?
At the time, that's what I felt called to do. And I remember the conversation I had, and I've shared this story many times, but my father, when I graduated from secondary school, my father wanted me to be a lawyer. That was his thing.
Everyone at those days.
Yeah.
Lawyer, and, doctor.
Right.
Yeah.
And when he finally sat down with me to have a conversation about what the next step will be, I'll never forget that conversation. Mm. He said, okay, son, so you need to tell me, what's the plan? What do you want to do? And he sort of knew from the time I was about 16, he could see that that was where I was going, but he just wanted to know where my headspace was. And he said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to study theology. He said, where do you want to go? I said, Louisiana. And I told him the school. It was Jimmy Swaggart Bible College.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
I haven't heard that name forever.
Yeah, but you remember Jimmy?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And he was my mentor, and I love him so much. He was. He still is my mentor. And
wow.
Yeah, well, it's true. And I remember my father saying to me, are you sure you want to go there? Why don't we do this? Why don't I send you to England? You study law, you do law, and then you go to America and do that.
Did you agree that?
I said, no, Dad, this is what I want to do. And you know, my father, my parents were such practical people.
Mm.
And my dad looked at my mother and said, the boy doesn't want to go there. What do we do? My mother said, just let him do what he needs to do. If he wants to do that later on, he can do it. So I went, and I loved every day of it. It was like a dream come true. I loved it. I spent 4 years on this college campus that was really my home for 4 years. And when I was done, at the end of it, I had this idea of permanently being there. You know, I wanted to.
But I need to still. No.
Go ahead.
Need to capture this. Mm. So, the way that you speak, is it taught? Because there is a way of pastoral speech.
Mm.
Is it taught?
Or? Yes, they teach you that. So they teach you how to speak.
They must do.
Yes, they
because
do.
Because you have to.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I would love to be in the room for that.
Yeah, they do, and I loved it there. It was such a great institution, and of course, you know, people have their own feelings about Jimmy Swaggart.
Of course,
and that's normal. But as far as I'm concerned, I loved being there. I learned so much there, and it was such a great family to be with. But you know, life being what it is,
how many Africans were there?
I was the only one, African. Right. I was the only one.
Yeah.
African, yeah, at the time.
Yeah.
Of course, I would imagine now it's changed. And in fact, funny you asked that, in Louisiana in the 19, because I was there from 89 to about 94 total.
Right.
Close to 95. I only ever met one Zambian who was going to, he was attending, him and his wife were attending Louisiana State University. And in those days, in the 80s, I could never find a Zambian community.
No.
You know, they were the only couple I knew.
No.
You go to Louisiana now, or any part of the States, there are huge Zambian communities.
Of course.
And just to give you a perspective, I had gone through 4 years. The only time I spoke my language was when I'd call my parents, because there was no one to speak my language with. But when I first came, after 4 years, my father wanted me to come home to be with the family before I went back to the States. And I was at an airport in London coming home, and I heard these two Zambians walking past me speaking Bemba. And I just ran up to them and I hugged them, because I hadn't heard Bemba in 4 years. and they were shocked. They said, "Who are you?" I said, "Hey, listen, man, I just love the fact that you're speaking Bemba. I hadn't spoken to anyone in Bemba."
That's incredible.
And it was wonderful. And I came, and then my dad said to me, "Well, you're done, and what do you want to do?" I said, "You know, I really want to go back and possibly live there. And I wanted to have a family there." And at the
time, was he mayor at the time?
No. This was many years later.
Okay.
Yeah, he was mayor in 1979, 1980, yeah.
Right.
And so I went back. Now, here's the problem. When I went back to the States, I didn't do all of my paperwork correctly. And I'll tell you a story that many people don't believe. When I got to New York City, the immigration guy, he looked at my document and he said, "Your visa's expired. You need to fix this." And at the time, I don't know why, he decided to call the school, the institution, and they wanted to verify if I was really part of the school. And the school verified, said, "No, he's one of us." Now, this was 1989. This would never happen today.
No.
This would never happen today.
Of course not.
Okay. And
made a call.
Yeah.
And they're like, "He's one of us."
Yeah, they let me through. But the immigration guy said to me, "You need to sort this out.
Fix it."
Yeah, fix it, or this is going to give you a problem.
Yeah.
Well, later, and I just took it for granted. Oh, I'll get to it. Well, we were in Shreveport, Louisiana. I'll never forget it. You know, it was, and for years I walked around with this shame. Shreveport, Louisiana, and I was trying to use my card, and the card declined. The owner of the business, instead of just saying, "Look, sort this out," he got nervous. He just called the police. This card declined. The police immediately asked me, "So where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Zambia. Can we see your passport?" Something that in those days, it wasn't common. I mean, in America, people don't just ask you for your passport.
Well, you just don't move around with
it. Yeah, well, you know.
Now you do.
Well, I did. I had it. And the moment he looked at it, he said, "I think your visa's expired, and we're going to hand you over to immigration." That was the beginning of bedlam. And the guy said to me, "Well, you're here illegally, and you need to go back." And of course, now, this was 2 years after I had returned. Okay.
And
this happened 2 years after.
Let it ride, and like, I'll get back to it.
And I kept on putting it off. And the lesson I learned was, you know, you think you've got it all together. You take it for granted that, look, I'll sort out the documents. As an illegal immigrant, if you don't dot all if you don't sort of cross all the T's and dot all the I's, then you run into that type of problem. And I did. And when they sent me back, that was one of the most shameful experiences of my life.
How do they send you back?
Well, they hold you, first of all. And when they deport you...
But hold you where?
There's a holding. I was in Caddo Parish. It's a place called Caddo Parish where they hold illegal immigrants. I was there for a couple of weeks.
And these are what we're hearing about now, where, like, you know, with the
raids.
With what's happening in Europe, well, not even in the States, like even in Europe, where they're like, no, immigrants are being held in this building or in this part, and like immigrant hotels, they're calling them. Is it something like that?
No, I wasn't in a hotel. It was a holding cell, a holding facility for illegal immigrants.
Right.
Yeah, and there were many people there. There were Spanish people there, people from Mexico, and all types of people. And then they just literally send you home. And they just woke me up one morning and said, okay, you're going back home. And they assigned me two offices, two immigration offices. So we flew from Shreveport, Louisiana, to New York City, from New York City to London. They go with you.
No.
They want to make sure you go to your country.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, there are two offices.
Then London, they know the plane's going direct.
Directly to Zambia.
Oh my goodness.
So in London, then they give you
your
documents and they say, sign our. And they tell you, they say, look, this is not, this doesn't mean you can never return to the States. It just simply means if you want to come back, follow the rules. And they're very serious about this. I mean, we're seeing what's going on now with Donald Trump and the raids. And there are people who have been in America for years.
Absolutely.
Who are not properly documented. Yeah. And they're going through the hell that I went through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But probably a lot of those are knowingly illegal.
Not even I was knowingly illegal. I just took it for granted that I'll sort it out.
Yeah.
But it cost me. But the plane ride, I'll tell you how shameful I felt. The plane ride coming home, I was just envisioning the disappointment on my father's face.
Did they know you were coming back?
You know, at the time, they weren't aware. And that's a good question. I'm sorry. I'm glad you asked that. I was so ashamed to tell them that this has happened. But I knew I had to face it.
Yeah.
When I landed and I got a taxi from the airport to home, my mother was so shocked to see me. But she just embraced me.
You, yeah.
And she hugged me. She said, you're back. What happened? And I explained it. And she was so disappointed, but she was so relieved I was home.
Mm.
My father, whom I was so afraid to disappoint, only had nothing but encouragement for me.
That's amazing.
He said, son, look, you messed up. It's okay. We pick up the pieces. And that's... And I'll be honest with you. I'm very thankful because... Had I lived in America, which is what my plan was, had I raised a family in America, I wouldn't have the sense of mind that I have now.
Of course not.
I am so happy being here.
Look at what you've done. Look at what you've discovered. Mm. What you've helped us discover. Mm. You definitely wouldn't have been the same person today.
I believe that, and I'm happier here.
Of course.
No diss to America. I love America.
Yeah.
But I love Zambia more.
And I think, in hindsight, if you were there now, it would be a very different place, space for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also family-wise, because that's one of the things I really wanted was a Zambian family. Nothing against Americans, but, I just felt I didn't want one foot here and one foot there with children and all that. So I'm glad that...
Well, you see, some of these things happen for very good reasons.
Absolutely.
So you came back and you were determined to now carry on with your vocation as a pastor?
Yes. Now, here's the thing. I went into a completely different direction. I went into the family business.
Well,
yeah.
as most people do.
But I still don't regret doing the course.
Yeah.
I loved it because I think the course made me, in a sense, who I am today. And for years, I used to struggle with that. I used to struggle with, trying to reconcile why I decided to go and then not end up doing what I went up.
But so many people are in that space, and for good reason, where you might study something.
And you do something else.
But maybe for you, you were maybe torn with the fact that you really had to persuade your parents that this is what you wanted to do when they wanted you to do something else. Maybe that's where you might have been a little bit torn.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's so many people that study one thing and we all do something else.
Mm.
I think that the studying or it's not about what you study, it's about the process and what you go through in those 3-4 years. I tell my son this as well. I said, you can study whatever you want. It's going to studying university teaches you to live with other people, understand other cultures, be able to communicate in other worlds, and not necessarily you know, become that engineer. It's about learning to teach you to live. That's what I believe.
Yeah.
So tell me what then happened. You decided I'm going to try this. Went into the family business.
Yeah, and I'm glad I did.
Simerson.
Yes. Well, with Simerson group of companies. Yes, we have several portfolios.
So. We know the Simerson.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Building.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so we went into that. And then a short time after that, for a few years later, my father passed away. Mm-hmm. And then we sort of, as a family, stepped up to the plate and drive the business forward. And that's where we are now.
And how many of you are there?
Seven. Okay. Although one passed away.
Okay.
Yes. And I'm the oldest, or the eldest.
I can feel that.
Right. And my mother's still alive, though, and my brothers and sisters are still alive. Over here in Lusaka, Zambia, it's only the four of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's myself, my two brothers, and one sister.
Okay.
And yeah.
And then, my memories of Simerson.
One sister here, two sisters in England. Because they're going to watch this and they say, but you didn't mention us.
He's mentioned you. my memories of Simerson were having to have my hair braided there.
Right.
And being dumped there at 9, because you're going back to school. Kaluke mishishi. Yeah. You're dumped there in some dodgy place.
I love that.
And
I love
I'm
that
like,
description.
You know. And then
some dingy place.
And then it's like the whole day, they're tugging at it, they're tugging at it hair. You cannot go to the loo, forget. And they bring you, I don't know if you got chicken and chips, what, cheap pie? Because you're there for like... And
cheap, then, not a pie, cheap pie.
And then sometimes you have to go back because they haven't finished. It was just grueling.
I know.
So I hated that building. Yeah.
What year was that?
Oh my gosh, this was in the
must
80s.
Have been, yeah.
80s.
Well, Simerson opened in 87. That should have been 88, 89,
exactly.
Maybe
it was,
90.
Look, it was still the new thing.
Yeah.
Because now, you know, this is where you braided your hair.
Right.
But I was traumatized.
Yeah.
So I really
I'm
need
so
to...
I'm so sorry.
No, I need to come back and just, you know, go through the process and
yeah.
make
well,
peace.
Well, we no longer have salons. Now. Well, there's one salon there.
I have to make peace.
But in those days, you have to make peace. In those days, we had different sorts of business. There were boutiques there.
Yes.
Now it's a different... It's a whole different... The building is now known for electronics, spare parts, and slot machines.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And that slot machine must be like, that's a really interesting business that's doing something.
Well, they trade. We've got Bola Bet there. They rent space there.
Right.
We have many different businesses there. But not the types of businesses that were there when you were there.
Right.
Yeah.
Over
the years, it's evolved.
I hope so.
It has.
It's
evolved.
Well done, though.
Well, we're trying.
So now the business at Simerson is evolved, and I'm really glad it has. Look, you know, it's one of the... I know there are other parts of the family business, or the Simerson business, but we all know the main building. But
right.
to have survived so many years is a really fantastic effort.
Absolutely.
And obviously driven by the family. Even a family business, believe me, most people by now would have just said, we're not handling it, we're selling it. But and to have stuck in there is incredible.
Well, I tell you now, and this is something that I constantly talk about, is that in the 80s, there were about 8 or 9 Zambian, black Zambian families that owned buildings along that street. Now, I'm the only one. We're the only ones. Everybody else
sold
is
out.
Indian, Chinese,
yeah.
Lebanese.
Yeah.
And the Zambians that are there are street vendors and marketeers.
Mm.
And it's not right. You know, we're living in the CBD where most of the commercial property is owned, is foreign owned.
Yes.
And nothing wrong with foreigners, but it really sort of irks me when I see very few black, I mean, literally, you can count them on 2 fingers, the number of commercial properties owned by black indigenous Zambians.
But how did you do that? How did you, as a family, how did you... managed to keep things going, stick with the program, and really succeed?
I love that question. It's all my dad. Mm. My father used to, when we were kids, it didn't matter where we were. I mean, I could be sitting down talking to my dad about football, and in mid-stride, he would look at me and say, "By the way, never sell Simoson." My father and I could be talking about, you know, what we ate in some restaurant that he loved, some dish that he loved.
Yeah.
In mid-stride, he would say, "Oh, and by the way, never sell Simoson." He drilled it into our heads, you know, and all of us, not just me.
Yeah.
So there was no question about, you know, offloading the property when my father passed away. In fact, my brothers and sisters and I, we are, as far as being on the same page, that's the one thing we're all on the same page about.
That's the key.
That is the key.
That's the key.
In fact, I mean, over the years, I'll tell you now, we've had many people offer us. There was some German guy that came here. He offered us $5 million to get the building. And we looked at him and said, "No, we're not selling it." And he said, $5 million? No, we're not selling it. All of us were on the same. And there is no division on that issue.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So that's your dad.
That's the key.
Installation of his legacy, actually.
Yeah. He drummed it into us.
Yeah. No, I can see you're still trembling a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, never sell.
Never. It didn't matter what you're talking about. He would always throw that in there. So, you know, last night, Manchester United won, but never sell Simoson.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So I hope you're drilling it into your kids.
Absolutely. All of us. You know, what's amusing is that I hear people on social media always say to me, "You, Mwewa, if it wasn't for your father, you would be just a street vendor."
There you go.
You know, and I say to them, "Look,
I probably would, yeah."
I wouldn't say. What I say to them is that, because they have this idea that it's only Simoson.
Yeah.
You know, it's not my business to start going on social media and unveiling my portfolio just for the sake of appeasing people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the reason Simoson is front and center is not only do I want to promote the businesses there. You know, I want to create a brand around that business.
You have?
Yeah.
And
that's the goal.
Yes.
But people misunderstand that. They know, if it wasn't for Simoson, you would have been just a street child, you know, somewhere.
Well, you've created a brand around it, and hence the story about the, you know, Simon Mwewa Lane. Because you had there's a thought process behind it.
Yeah.
Meaning there must also have been a thought process when you started your conversations and your podcasts.
Yes.
What kicked that off?
Yeah.
You know, you've told me that it was when there was cholera, you were videoing and sort of seeing this traction of attention and comments. And then it grew into?
Yeah. Well, the original idea was to show life in and around Simoson within the CBD.
Mm.
You know, I, in a sense, like a video diary.
Mm.
My idea was, you know, 50 years from now, when I'm no longer here, people will watch these videos and they will say, "Oh, so that's how they lived on this street.
Yeah.
That's how they dressed. Those are the types of conversations they had."
Mm.
You know, that's the idea. Now, unfortunately, I live in a country. Of course, this idea is evolving now, but I live and I work around people. I am surrounded by imbeciles. Surrounded by imbeciles. Why I say this is because every time I walk around with a camera, why you go? Why are you photographing you? Yeah? Why are you talking? And I keep saying to them, "Guys, this is a video diary. This is going to show people that are not here now, that are going to be here even 100 years from now, that are going to look back and say, 'Wow, this is how the..." Ah, how's that going?
But they must be used to you now.
They are now.
Or you always find a new guy.
Yeah. No. They are now. But in the beginning, it was very difficult because they just couldn't wrap their brain around that. It was just something they just could not grasp.
So now they also know, because they've also been watching, so they're also followers.
Yes.
And they also know, actually, he's promoting Simoson in their eyes.
And the area.
Yeah.
Now we also know, because as you know, there's a market that was recently opened.
Yes.
Which was named after my late father as well. It's called the Simon Mwewa Lane Market. Even that, we sort of asked the government, The original name of the market was Lumumba Road Market. Before they even broke ground, they had already decided on a name. And I'll never forget when then Vice President Inongawina, she came to break ground. And I was standing on the property after everybody left, after the ceremony, the groundbreaking ceremony. I was standing on the property. This was, nothing had been built there. It was just a piece of land.
Yeah.
And I was standing with the district commissioner, the DC of Lusaka, at the time, Captain Mulenga. And I asked him, I said, so why did you guys name this thing Lumumba Road Market? And jokingly, half-wittingly, he said, what do you want us to name it after your dad? I said, you know, that would be a great idea. And let me tell you why. Because if you say Lumumba Road Market, Lumumba Road is such a long stretch of road.
Yeah.
If you say you Lumumba Road, do you mean Lumumba Road, Dooley Motors, Family 24, Auto World, further down? He says, okay, I'll tell you what you do. Put it in writing and copy everybody. Send me a copy, send the TC, write the mayor, write local government, write everybody. So I did. As soon as I left there, I went straight to my office, typed the letter, boom, sent it out. 6 months later, I was walking into a barber shop, and Vincent Mwale was the local minister of, the minister of local government at the time. It was, in those days, it was called local, the Minister of Local Government and Housing. It's now Local Government and Rural Development.
Gosh, okay.
So I was walking into a barbershop on number 3 Chaholi Road. Walking in, he was walking out. The moment he saw me, he said, Simon Mwela, I know what you're going to ask me. I already saw your letter. It's under review. No promises. We'll let you know. I said, okay. The very next day, I get a letter from Lusaka City Council. We have decided to name the market after your father in light of the contribution that he made to this community. And they named. Now, the problem was, when it was announced that it was now Simon Mwela, this was during the PF. I had always had difficulties with the PF cadres. They never liked me and I never liked them. So the moment they heard that the market was named after, oh my goodness, all of hell broke loose. They went to Vincent Mwela and they said, how the hell can you name it that? This guy, if you name it that, this guy is going to be walking into the market, kicking tables and saying, "Idi market ya wata ta fume ni." You know, we laugh, but I'm telling you, that's how they thought. Vincent Mwale had to explain to them that, look, it's just a name after his father. He doesn't own the building. No! Sitfuna! They had to convince them. So even now, I mean, recently you heard that I was stoned by the marketeers. Still, there is a remnant of that thought. The reason I was stoned was simply because I was saying, look, let's have a clear, open passage in the market where people can freely walk through. Don't block the corridors and the entrances and the drainage systems. That is what got me stoned. And while they were stoning me, they were saying, you know, that's why Tatulefuachi market wachinikati Simon Mwela. Yeah, so it's a constant battle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how do you manage the battle and why are you still battling it?
You know, the truth is, it's because I feel that like I'm honoring my father.
Mm.
And I feel him. I really do. I sense him. And that's what keeps me going. Sometimes it's discouraging, you know. Like this morning, I was lamenting this morning about, you know. Sometimes you feel like you're doing things all by yourself,
yes.
And there's no assistance from local government or the Lusaka City Council in terms of cleanliness of the street. I mean, I personally pay people to sweep that street. It shouldn't be my job. I should not be doing that.
I feel a bit.
But
like,
I do.
I feel a bit. Like you'd never run for mayor, I'm sure. But I feel like a kind of a mayor in the CBD.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, the issue of mayor, for me, I feel, and I'm flattered when people say that, but the truth is, for me, I don't think it's always necessary to attain a political position to achieve a communal goal.
Mm.
You can do it that way, and if that's your goal and that's your desire, that's fine. You know, you're fine to do that, to run for mayor. But I don't think that it's imperative to be mayor to bring change to your community. I believe that community organizes.
Well, you've made change.
Yeah, well, you know, in a, to a degree.
Is your mother proud of you?
She says she is, and I believe her.
Yeah.
You know, she is. And, you know, so our goal is just to be members of a community that functions.
Yeah.
That's all. You know, our goal has always been misunderstood because, you know, one of the things the street vendors always say to me, or traders, and I constantly battle this. I face this every day. I've been facing it for years.
Yeah.
Is, you are rich, we're poor, we're trying to make a living on the street, and you are blocking that goal. And I said, that's not it. You've missed the point. The reason I don't want you to be on the street, I want you to be in the markets. Because in the markets, you have access to shelter, clean water, toilets. You pay your stipend to the council. You pay a rent to the council that the council uses to fix roads, lights. You become an economic participant.
Mm.
On the street, you are nothing. You are a liability on the street. My people don't see it that way. They simply don't. You can explain it from here till kingdom come. They will never see it. And everything is shrouded and covered in, no, you're rich, we're poor. You're taking advantage of us. And it's never about that. Never. And nobody, not me, not my siblings, not a single person ever walks around, I'm rich.
Yeah.
No.
It's not even that.
We've come to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or I'm sure no one looks at it as, you know what, I work as hard as you do.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness. If you say that to them, oh, they'll cuss you out. They will swear at you if you say, I work just as hard as you do. Because when I go to work, I'm there at 7:30.
Mm.
I work, I do my thing, my videos, I do my Simoson work, I balance everything out. I leave at 18:30. I don't sit at home waiting for rent. I mean, I could do that, but I don't do that.
Mm.
Why? Because I know that I have to be part of this community.
Yeah, you have a responsibility.
Absolutely.
As well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Tell me about your family. Tell me about your wife.
Yes.
Yeah.
My wife, we've been married now 25 years.
Nice.
Yeah.
So and obviously you met her when you were
In school. We went to the same school.
When you were in Zambia?
Yeah, here in Zambia. In fact, my wife and the current mayor of Lusaka, Chilando Chitangala, she's my niece.
Right.
Yeah, Chilando is my niece. My wife, Chilando Chitangala, who's the mayor of Lusaka, and myself, were in the same class.
No way.
Yes. And, but in those days, my wife was just a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And our families, her family and my family, they knew each other. And when I came back from the States, when I started feeling this need to be married, and I must tell you, that was one of the scariest parts of my life. Because I never wanted to make a mistake. You know, you always have this idea that what if
a mistake in marriage or just a mistake?
No, a mistake in marrying the wrong person.
Right.
Yeah. I had two fears when I was younger. The first fear was, will I marry the right person? Second fear was, will I be able to have children? Oh, that one used to keep me up at night. Lord have mercy. I used to say, oh Lord, if I get married and all of a sudden the doctor tells me you can't have kids, I'm going to die, Lord, I'm going to die.
I never actually realized that it must be a big fear.
Oh, it was a big, I was 20 years old.
You're saying it, but yeah. It must be a big fear in people.
Yeah, it is.
Before they have children.
Absolutely. I'm very glad to report that on both counts.
To report.
Yeah, on both counts, it turned out okay. I married the right girl and I got kids. We got four kids together. Yeah. And you know, her and I, I'll never forget she had gone to the University of Hull in England.
Yes.
And when she graduated, she had come back here to just say hello to all of her schoolmates. And at the time, I had just come out of a relationship that didn't work. Nothing, she wasn't a bad person. She was a wonderful person, but we just didn't gel, you know. And there are people like that you just don't gel with, you know. And I'd just come out of this relationship, and my wife had come to visit us. And I was so happy to see her. And the moment she walked in, in my spirit, I thought, there she is. That's the one. We talked, you know, and of course she wasn't thinking that way. She was just saying hello to her old classmate. Yeah. When she left, my mother was at the house, and my mother said, you know what? That's a good woman there. And that's the type of woman I would love to see you with.
Oh, my goodness.
6 months later, we were married.
No.
Yeah. That was 25 years ago. 25 years ago.
Doesn't happen like that much anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. Mm. Yeah. And your kids?
4 kids. And they're great kids.
All here?
Yes.
Okay.
And
Do they help out in the family business?
Not yet, no. Because my first one's a doctor. The second one is, she's a doctor at UTH. Second one was studying dentistry in China, but because of COVID, he had to come back, so he's doing that here. My third one is a law student. My last one is studying data science. The thing about my kids is that, and this is how God redeemed me, because, I mean, I never considered myself a real super smart person, but through my kids, I've lived vicariously through my kids because, you know, God gave me these amazing kids, you know, and that's how I felt that. The truth is, even though my father never said it, because my dad was all about encouragement. My dad would never talk down at you. He would never make you feel less than. He always saw the brighter side of things. No matter how much you messed up, he'd always say to me, you know what? Turn over a new leaf. It's going to be fine. But deep down in his heart, I always felt he was disappointed that I didn't do it the way he wanted it to be done. He wanted me to study law, then do that. But I didn't do that way. But the redeeming part of it is I see it in my kids. That, you know, through my kids, you know, things... Sorry, I'm going to start crying.
Oh, come on, Simon. That's incredible. No, that's great. What do they think about your podcasting and how you have become really quite influential? What do they... Do they support you on that? Do they help you with it? Are they behind the camera? Are they like, no, Dad, you need to do it like this? Or do they just let you get along with it?
That's a good question. Let me tell you, my kids, especially when I go through controversies, they worry about me.
Right.
Yeah. There's one time my kids, my wife said to me, she said, you know, the kids want to talk to us. And it was like an intervention. You know, all my kids gathered in the living room and they said, Dad, you know what? We worry about you. We worry that people talk about you the way they do. They attack you. Maybe it's time to take a back seat. We don't want to see you hurt. We don't want to hear that your dad's been shot, killed somewhere. Mm-hmm. So we think that you should sort of maybe take a back seat.
Mm.
And I say to my kids, you know, I'm a social media commentator. That's what I do. Of course, I'm not going to deliberately place myself in harm's way, but that's what I do. And you know, my wife, and they're supportive, but they worry. They really do. Oh, and that's the truth.
They have been many situations where, of course, they would worry.
Yeah, they worry. And sometimes they... And to remedy that, they don't watch my content because they don't want to read the comments.
Yeah,
they say to me, Dad, you know, I can't stomach some of the things people say. And also, because of this, my kids are not really present on social media. Because they don't want to go through school and
their
friends being telling them this, that, and the other. I mean, a couple of times, you know, my daughter who's studying, she's just done law, just this is her fourth year. She told me once, she said one of her friends discovered that I was her father and walked up to her and said, why did your dad say this? And my daughter said, well, you know what? You're going to have to talk to my dad about that. Okay? Why don't you go talk to him?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how they shield themselves. They've
safeguarded themselves from that.
It's not easy to do because being a public figure, well, that's what they call us, public figures and all that. But deeply, I do think about this.
Yeah.
And I'm 56 years old now. What I want to go into in the next portion of my life as I approach 60 is I want to do something like this where I just sit and talk to people rather than being on the front lines out in the street, you know, because I'm getting old now, and that's, it's tiring, you know, dodging stones and insults, it gets very tiring.
No, I know. And I mean, there was one incident when you were, you know, spent some time away, put away, when you slashed tires.
Yes.
Slashed
tires. I love it. But here's the story. This is the truth of the story. You know, bus drivers in that area, they always park their buses in front of our building. And for years we've had this problem. Yeah. And for years we've engaged the bus driver association. Look, please tell your drivers not to do this, because when they park, they block the gates. We can't leave. We can only leave when they decide to drive off. So this particular evening, I said to my guards, deflate the tires, meaning release the air from the tires,
right,
so that he knows not to do this. What are those jokers, the driver and the conductor? What do? Because the tires were bald, they were worn out.
Mm-hmm.
They said, oh, Mewa has done this. Let's puncture the tires and then make him buy new tires. So the owner of the bus came to me.
This is a lot of energy.
Oh, yeah. This is what I go through.
Everything.
So the guy comes to me and says, hey, listen, man, you, the word he used was, okay, you punctured them.
Yeah.
I said, no, I deflated them. He couldn't understand the difference. I said, hey, my boy, hey.
No.
I said, I deflated, not puncture. There's a difference. He says, no, and he gave me a quotation. This is almost 6,000 kwacha. Immediately, I said, oh, I see what you're doing here. You're trying to extort money from me. You want me to buy you brand new tires for something that you've done. I'm not doing it. Oh, I'm going to take you to court. I said, take me to court. Now, I didn't want to hire a lawyer because I'd spend minimum 15,000 kwacha just for the lawyer. He wants 6,000. Why would I spend 15,000 when I know he wanted to extort money from me? We go to court. They messed up their own testimony. I decided to be silent. I remember the judge, and it was only in retrospect that I realized what the judge was saying to me. When it came time for me to give my side of the story, I was silent. The judge turned to me and said, Mr. Mwema, you've been charged with malicious damage, which is a very serious offense. Is there anything you'd like to say in your defense? I said, nothing. And he looked at me and said, Mr. Mwema, are you sure? I said, yeah. In my mind, because their testimony was already conflicting, I thought the judge would see that. When he sentenced me to 6 months, I was so shocked. When I got to the prison and I shared my story, the prisoner said, well, that's where you made the mistake. You were silent. You should have given your side of the story. By you being silent, the judge felt that you were probably hiding something. And that's why I sent it.
So you got advice in the prison?
In the prison, yeah. And it was in that moment that I realized silence is not golden. Sometimes. Yeah.
Well, there you go, actually.
Yeah. I was there for 6 days, and it was quite, but you know, it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be.
Mm.
Yeah. Because initially I went to Kamwala.
Yes.
And Kamwala was, I was scared to go there because, you know, I just wasn't sure what I'd find there, but everybody in there was so kind to me. They gave me a nice mattress. I spent one night there. The following morning, the warden comes to me and says, Mr. Mwera, we have been instructed to send you to Mwembeshi because apparently someone thinks you'll be more comfortable there. I said, why do I have to? He said, no, just pack your things there. Two people coming to pick you up. So vehicle comes, two officers, in plain clothes, suits, a woman and a man. And they said, Mr. Mwema, we're here to pick you up. We're going to take you to Mwembeshi. You know, it was a Land Cruiser. So I sat in the back. We drove off. They pulled out my phone, handed it to me. I said, Mr. Mwema, you can call wherever you want. The only thing, don't go live or we lose our jobs.
Don't start streaming now.
Don't start streaming here. Yeah, so I called my family. I told them where I was. I got to Mwembeshi. It was a beautiful facility. Beautiful. The only thing, though, is that it's not well-funded in terms of food. Because if you don't have someone bring you food, the food, the prison food there, it's inhumane. They have, for morning meals, breakfast, they have what they call, it's samp. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
But their type of samp is so overboiled that the moment you put it in your mouth, it literally just melts. You don't even chew it. It just melts in your mouth, tasteless. Mm. And then for lunch, they only have two meals a day, breakfast and lunch. Technically, they're supposed to have three. They only have the two. Lunch is something called daga. Ever heard of daga?
No.
It's a type of kapenta. More stone than anything else. I mean, literally, you're chewing stone.
Crunching.
Yeah, crunching stone. And within Shima, that's it. So if you don't have a support system, you're doomed.
So look, you've survived many incidences, so I can again understand how your family is
worried. Yes.
And looking forward, you're saying, and you do a very diligent job getting information out there. Your podcast has got thousands of followers up, and I don't know how many, maybe millions. Mm. And you're seeing yourself maybe just taking a back seat at some point.
Yeah.
Can really finish on that.
Yeah, in the next 3 or 4 years, I want to be doing this.
Yeah,
I have I want to do this. I've got a space there at Simulson Building.
Yeah,
I'm gonna turn it into a little studio just to sit and relax and talk to people the way you're talking to me.
Yeah,
yeah, sort of like a Dan Rather sort of deal where you just, you know, not being on the front lines, because I'm tired of the front lines.
No, I mean, you know, when I hear your stories and it's every day there's gonna be something. Of course you can be tired, but you've done a fabulous job for the CBD.
Thank you.
So now you're going to take a back seat in the next couple of years, but you've done some really amazing stuff.
Thank you.
And I want to ask, what do you see that Zambians respond to on your podcasts, on your conversations? What do you see, like, spikes, the likes, and they see that you're doing?
Well, not just mine.
Yeah.
Every single platform on social media, in the social media space, Zambians respond to innuendo and gossip. That is what piques Zambians' interests. Because if you talk about the economic situation in Zambia, nobody talks about that.
Yeah.
You know, if you talk about climate change, nobody talks about that. But if you talk about someone who slept with someone's wife, oh honey, you're gonna get so many people on there. And we're a society, it's a human condition, I think. It's not just Zambian, it's a human condition.
Yeah.
People respond to that sort of thing more than anything else.
No, it's true, actually. Yeah. I mean, when you find what's happening on, you know, we want to know about film stars and the bad side of it, and someone's taking somebody to court.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
That's,
yeah. And also here, and also politics in Zambia, politics. Mm-hmm. The innuendo of the political space in Zambia is... only because it's so contentious.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you must, looking at your work, you do a lot of research, you do a lot of reading. So you pick up a lot of content. And then how do you plan it? You're like, this is what I'm going to do tomorrow. This is what I want to speak about. But you must collect a lot of information.
Well, if I'm doing what I call these talking heads, you know, I've got the camera in my office.
Yes.
I do a little bit of reading so that I know what I'm talking about. But usually I don't follow a script. I just have bullet points, and then I go with that. And I try to keep my I call them dissertations. I try to keep them under 25 minutes because I've noticed on social media, everything for me is just based on what I would feel. I can't watch something for an hour unless it's a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if I'm listening to people talk, I'll take it in snippets, you know. 25 minutes, I feel, is a good time.
People are going to watch you for an hour. I'm telling you this right
really?
Now. Yeah.
So that's, to answer your question, I do a bit of research and then I do my thing and then I'm out of there,
And then what's, you were leading the Icon. Tell me a little bit about that.
I love that. David Kazadi, who I consider to be one of the greatest filmmakers in this country, approached me. He called me one day.
As they do.
He says to me, we're doing the show and we want you to be. And I said, Dave, and because he called me, I said, I don't know what you're talking about, but whatever it is, yes. Because I know the type of quality he brings to any project. And, you know, he invited me in. My concern was the way I would look, because I'm not very fashionable. I'm not into fashion.
But you're very present.
Well, thank
you. You're very present, and you know, you present well
thank
on screen,
you.
Yes.
Thank you. And that was my concern. I told him, I said, you know, I want to do it, but are you gonna do my wardrobe? Because I don't know how to do all
that. So tell me about the program. What is it?
It was a talent show.
Yeah.
Yes. It was like Idols.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was the host of it. And going in, very early on, I was very, worried that I wouldn't do a good job because I'd never done anything like that.
Hmm.
Yeah. But he was very encouraging. And when you have someone, when you're working with someone that has a clear vision of what
yes.
they want, they sort of transfer that to you, that energy to
yes.
you. And he was always high energy.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be done, and not just done, but done at this level. So he always brought his A game. And so all of us, not just myself, the judges, the guys who were shooting, everybody was on point.
Yeah, no, you've got a great producer, director
yeah.
that can really
yeah.
translate.
And I loved it. It was hard work because it was very demanding, but I really enjoyed it. And this season two, they're going with a different host,
okay.
which is normal, you know, because you want that diversity.
Yes, yes, yes.
You want that fluidity.
Yes.
And I'm confident that whoever David chooses as the next host will bring the same sort of energy to the project. Yeah.
That's awesome. Mm. Now, something I'm still really fascinated about is the pastoral side to you.
Mm.
I haven't really gotten in there.
Yeah.
Where does it sit with you right now? Where does it sit in your life, in your home, in your children,
mm.
on your Sundays, in your daily life? Where is that? Spiritually.
Well, I mean, I am a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an active Christian.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I used to beat myself over the head over was I felt guilty for not having gone into the ministry. And for years I battled with that.
Mm.
Especially, you know, I come from a Judeo-Christian sort of background
mm.
where people will throw a scripture in your face and say, the calling of God is without repentance,
mm.
you know, and you know, you're called of God, and you're a man of the cloth. You know, they say that to you constantly. And so for me, I the way I reconciled that was I decided that you don't always have to stand behind a pulpit in order to be a Christian, you know.
No.
Yeah, you don't always have to stand behind a pulpit in order to preach the message of the cross. Your life can be a testimony.
Yeah.
Although I must tell you, I'm not the greatest example, though. I mean, I will be honest with you. But that's just the truth.
And that's just between us?
Yeah. And them. Yeah, but to answer your question, the way I reconciled it was, you know, you don't always have to be standing behind a pulpit
yeah.
to preach the gospel. Your life can be a testimony.
It's a testimony.
Yeah.
I believe that. And I have had a number of people on this, because I'm very curious about how religion has... or spirituality has evolved in this very fast-moving world and how people are taking it with them, especially our generation, where it was really such a key part of your upbringing, and also more so those before us, you know, and just how looking at how people are now handling that in a very different world and translating that to their children. So I find it really, really fascinating. And I've heard similar answers from others who have said, actually, you know what, at this point, it's about how I live my life.
Mm.
It's not about being seen at church and wearing a Catholic Women's League chikwembe. You know.
Chikwembe. I love it.
No, it's about how I live my life. And it's in different ways.
Mm.
Yeah, no, I love that. No, I love that. For me, Simon, this has been a great morning. And you've really taught me a lot. And I think we touched some areas that, I mean, I'm pleased I touched, and
thank you.
I think you probably heard bits of yourself that you didn't expect to hear.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm really appreciated for that, and thank you for sharing, like, deep, deep.
Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you so much. There's no us without you, so we say thank you.